On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats of Alperen Şengün's three-point shooting. League leader? Will that be a bigger part of his game this year? Also, how much stock should we put into Game 1 for Warriors, Lakers, Rockets, and Thunder? Plus, our thoughts on the NBA back on NBC and Michael Jordan's TV debut as a special contributor. All this coming up right now. Welcome, 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 welcome to The Big Number. I'm Tom Haberstroh, and it's opening night. It's done. We made it, Dan. Tuesday night, we got maybe the game of the year right off the bat. Houston, Oklahoma City, and then an epic battle between these two great Western powers, Golden State and the Lakers, and skinny Luka is there. Al Horford, 80-year-old Al Horford is playing. NBA on NBC is back, and so are we, Dan. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing great. Yeah, I love that it's like, we made it. It's over. Opening night. It's begun, and it's done. Our long national nightmare of no NBA games is over, and here we are. I mean, the NBA, extremely smart. We're going to start, and also NBC as a new partner. We're going to start with no Eastern Conference. All Western Conference, thank you very much. We're going to go with the defending champs and Kevin Durant and Stephen Curry and Luka Doncic. How's that sound? Does that sound good? First picks? And it worked out. Yeah, I mean, an awfully high bar to clear in terms of opening night drama, for sure.
Yeah, we're going to get into all that. We're going to talk about Michael Jordan's debut on the program as an analyst or as an excellence expert.
Eminence? Yeah. It's difficult to, you know, like, it doesn't seem like analyst is right. We'll get there.
Yeah. But we're gonna do a big number here. This week's big number is 5. That's the number of three-pointers made by the NBA's league leader in the category. Drum roll, please. Alperen Şengün. What? What? Dan, where did this come from? Alperen Şengün, Houston Rockets all-star. Extended one of the great foundational pieces of the Houston Rockets and one of the best players in the Western Conference, just became Steph Curry overnight. And okay, I should say tied for the league lead with Buddy Hield, who hit 5 three-pointers as well on opening night, Tuesday night. But Alperen Şengün, the Turkish big man, came off this like amazing Eurobasket run for Turkey that won silver behind Germany. And Alperen Şengün had 39 points, 7 assists, 11 rebounds, 2 steals, a block, and hit 5 of 8 three-pointers, which is, like, what does this do for the Rockets? What does this do for, like, Alperen Şengün's trajectory in the league? Like, a lot of things will kind of change if Alperen Şengün is like a knockdown three-point shooter. And I will say, last year, he was not a knockdown three-point shooter, Dan. Last year, he shot just 23.3% on 1.2 three-point attempts per game. He's a career 27.9% three-point shooter in, what, 4-plus seasons in the NBA. Dan, of all of the things that we saw on opening night, between the NBC stuff, the ring night, KD coming back to OKC and getting booed, MJ, Steph and Jimmy Butler, all this stuff that we saw, I don't think anything was as surprising as Alperen Şengün turning into a legit three-point shooter for a night.
Absolutely not. Though we should say one thing that it didn't do for the Rockets, or doesn't do for the Rockets, is get them an opening night win over Oklahoma City. The Thunder go on and they win 125-124 in double overtime with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander going nuts after halftime, finishing with 35 points, 5 rebounds, and 5 assists, kind of picking up where he left off. Pretty nice way to end ring night, banner night for a Thunder team that was already without Jalen, or also without Jalen Williams, as he continues to work his way back from wrist surgery. So, Şengün monster numbers, not in a win. We'll get to something similar happening in the Lakers-Warriors game later. Similar giant numbers, not a win. But I think the most eye-opening thing absolutely was like, wait a second, is this guy going to be a volume shooter? And part of it, obviously, like he made 21 threes all of last season in about 2,400 minutes. So he's about a quarter of the way to last season's numbers. He made, I love this just as a fun little fun with numbers thing. About 4.5% of his total career three point makes came last night. So he's been playing for, this is his fifth season, and about 5% of his made threes came last night. So this was, yes, it is a surprise. It is a new movement in Alperen Şengün's career. When you think about the structure of the Rockets right now, especially, we've talked a lot about Fred VanVleet going out. One of the great sort of placeholder things about Fred VanVleet, what he provided for the Rockets, was volume floor spacing. Not always like a 40% shooter, but somebody that would take the shot, that would open up the defense, try to create more space in the half court by letting it go. And the Rockets, as they exist now, with Amen Thompson sliding in as the point guard, the nominal point guard, in double big, everybody big, gigantic big lineups. If you're going to have Amen Thompson not be a real floor spacer, and if you're going to have Steven Adams not be a real floor spacer, it's got to come from someplace. And if it can come from Şengün, that does open up some really interesting possibilities for what this Rockets offense could be.
Yeah. I mean, it's his age 23 season. So, like, historically, he might have been a rookie in, you know, eras past. So the fact that he would add a three-point shot to his arsenal is not totally outlandish.
Sure.
And it would be totally transformative for this Rockets team, like you said, that is really, really seeking that floor spacing element that we'll get into this later, too, is Reed Sheppard was the best three-point shooter in the NBA, in NCAA ranks, and a big reason why he was picked third, number three, by the Houston Rockets. Keep your third eye open. And I do think Reed Sheppard had a really tough night. My son, Reed Sheppard. But
we're going to get into that, Tom.
Yeah, yeah. I've got plans. I talked to the missus, and we've got plans. I feel like Alpi needs to do this if the Rockets want to hit the highest levels, because it's not going to come from Steven Adams. It's not, or Clint Capella. Kevin Durant has been always a good three-point shooter, but a somewhat reluctant three-point shooter. I think there is something to say about Kevin Durant being part of this three-point revolution. The trajectory of three-point shots in the NBA didn't seem to really affect KD's volume in a way that it's added a lot of players to add, or it compelled a lot of players to add a three-point shot. KD's been like, I will take it if it's open, but he's not going for 10, 12 three-pointers a night. So even though he's one of the greatest shooters ever, it isn't really part of his game to be a 10 three-point attempt kind of guy. Now, with Alperen Şengün, I have been a big believer in him since day one. When on draft night, I was on Lebatard's show and I called my shot. Dan, I said that Alperen Şengün should be the number one overall pick. And none of them knew who I was talking about.
That's right. That's right.
Like, do you remember when you first heard of Şengün? Like,
I was thinking about it, because I mean, I am admittedly not super plugged in on stuff like, you know, like the FIBA under 19s and stuff like that. Like I or even necessarily a lot of the bigger Eurobasket clubs. Like I kind of like figure things out with European prospects as they drip into the league. So my introduction to Şengün was like, oh, this is the guy that talks to the ball at the free throw line. Like that was kind of what I knew of him. Like, oh, he's a quirky odd duck. Yeah. And then as like, you got more longer look at him, you're like, oh, this dude can really play. So I was absolutely not nearly as early on the bandwagon as you. I imagine that the response to they should pick the Turkish guy number one overall was a little bit of let's say some skepticism. But I think what we've seen so far through those first four seasons and then through the Eurobasket performance with having Turkey go to the silver medal this past summer, you've got somebody who can be like, at this point, the comparisons feel almost like reductive, saying, oh yeah, it's sort of like Jokic. It looks a little bit like Jokic, big guy with great touch, shoots from weird angles, has the wrong foot, great passer. And like, but nobody can really get to that level. I mean, if Alperen Şengün is going to be somebody who can make a steady diet of threes on serious volume with the interior mauling game that he's got, with the playmaking, with the ability to face up from the three-point line and drive people in. Like, maybe it's not crazy.
Yeah. I think we all call him like Baby Jokic. I think we should start calling him Maybe Jokic. Like maybe, like maybe he can be like in that category. I'm not saying he's going to be top 10 all the time.
Sure.
But like, again, if he adds this 3-point shot, all bets are off. All bets are off because he's already this hub of the offense, amazing passer like Jokic, an amazing passer, incredible touch around the basket. His one-on-one like matchup against Jokic in the Eurobasket this summer was some of the best basketball you will ever see. And he's got a very similar game. He's not as big as Jokic, but if he does add like a legit 3-point shot in the same way that Jokic did, yes, you are going to see Alperen Şengün get into the MVP conversation. Right now, at BetMGM, he's plus 30,000 to win the MVP. So if you put $100 on Alperen Şengün to win MVP, that's 30K in your pocket, which in today, I don't know what a 30K gets you these days in today's economy. Damn, we're not going to get into that.
No, but probably not a good idea.
I would say I'm a little surprised that it isn't shorter odds for Alperen Şengün considering what he showed on opening night. But if this 3-point shot is real, and we have seen players add a 3-point shot, I'm thinking about Brook Lopez,
sure,
bigs who just were like had really good touch around the basket and then extended their range all the way to the 3-point line. But Dan, like we haven't seen anything like this from Alpi until this summer. And you unearthed some quotes that I think we should bring up here about Şengün working this into his repertoire. And yeah, we always hear this, training camp, hope springs eternal. But there does seem to be some real meat behind these bones.
Yeah, this is from Danielle Lerner at the Houston Chronicle, does great work on the Rockets beat there. Quote, Şengün spent the summer in Turkey developing his outside shot, going through rep after rep with his personal skills trainer to improve the fluidity of his motion. The Thunder dared Şengün to shoot and he punished them. Sharpshooting was especially needed to space the floor in the Rockets' double big lineup, something Şengün said he's determined to keep doing. Definitely, he said, I need to open that space. I've been working on it all summer, so I just let it fly, you know, shoot it with confidence. And that's what I did today. And so that's, I mean, what we've seen. It seems very clear, obviously, the decision to stay with Steven Adams in the starting lineup and slide Amen Thompson to the point. Like, this was not plan A for Ime Udoka, but in the absence of Fred VanVleet and given the other options that are on the table right now in the guard room for the Rockets, this is what Udoka feels most comfortable with. He feels like it gives them the best chance to have an elite defense, and it gives them the best chance to generate more possessions, to have that physical identity of we are going to, even if we miss a bunch of shots, we're going to get the rebounds. We're going to get second chance opportunities. We're going to like basically shoulder block and juggernaut our way into a near top 10 offense. And that becomes easier to arrive at if one of your two front court players is a floor spacer. And Şengün is not, I mean, I think we often think of the stretch four as being more like Jabari Smith Jr., who I guess is now just a small forward or maybe a shooting guard.
Yeah.
Last night he was in double overtime, I believe he was guarding Shai Gilgeous-Alexander at the point of attack. Based, you know, so like, who knows what position, you know, positional designations maybe don't apply once you get inside the city limits of Houston. But this is the identity they want to lean into. We want to be big. We want to be physical. We want to mash you on, in the post. We want to mash you on the boards. But in order for that to function in the half court, there needs to be space and some way to create the driving lanes for Amen Thompson to get downhill, which we saw him doing a little bit more successfully later in the game, for Kevin Durant to be able to get into his spots in the mid range, as opposed to just having a 5-car pile up in and around the paint. And Şengün being the deliverer of that, the avenue to creating that space, makes a lot of sense for the Rockets as currently constructed. And that path is down that road can lie some awfully big numbers. And then if you get that production, you know, we talk a lot on this show about the advanced stats, right? About, you know, estimated plus minus, about value over replacement player, a lot of these sort of all-in-one metrics that might be able to give you a better holistic picture of a player's individual impact on the game. Last season, as Şengün rose to all-star status, he was somewhere between like top 15 and top 35 in a lot of those.
Right,
box
right.
plus, yeah, box plus minus, win
all-star,
share.
All-star, fringe all-star type. Yeah.
Yes. You add into that the possibility of a boost in three-point shooting rate and three-point shooting accuracy, what that can do for your individual scoring. Combine that with what he gives you on as a rebounder, on the offensive glass, his facilitation. Underrated defender, similar to Jokic because of the space he takes up. He's not an above-the-rim rim protector, but really smart, great hands, good positionally. Udoka would not lean on him the way he does if he could not function in that way. And so that several points per game jump, or that efficiency jump, that can be the distance between fringe all-star and all-NBA. And if you're in that all-NBA mix, you are basically like a my team's really good away from MVP ballot.
Yeah.
And, you know, at this point, I think we think the Rockets have a chance to be very good on that level. I don't think losing a double overtime game on the road to the defending champions should dissuade us from that notion. But yeah, if you're talking about skill additions and evolutions of individual players that could be transformative for the way the league works out this year, Şengün with the three-point shot's a pretty good one right off the rip.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about what this does for his game too, is just if he can be a legitimate threat from down there. Like, a lot of times OKC was just like letting him shoot, right? Was just like, hey, go ahead. And that's actually what Jokic did against him at Eurobasket, was like, yeah, I'm just going to stand here at the free throw line. You go take that shot.
Yep.
If they start having to close out on Alperen Şengün, damn.
Whole world changes, yeah.
Holy shnikes. Like, Alperen is so... Alpi's so good at that pump fake, that slow pump fake that gets all the defenders to bite in the same way that Jokic does. And Jokic becomes unstoppable with that three-point shot, with that slow pump fake, and then just go and get downhill, and then the defense collapses, and then they can spray out or just get a layup at the rim, Euro step, whatever footwork that Jokic and maybe Jokic do. You know, like... I just think it opens up so much for the Rockets if he becomes a credible three-point threat, not just because of the three-pointers, but because of the three-point threat and the gravity that he would have on the opposing big. I just want to point out, just last year with the double big lineup, I'm talking Şengün and Steven Adams out on the floor, according to PBPstats.com, Fred VanVleet on the floor with those two double bigs last year, their three-point rate, the percentage of shots that come from downtown, was 43%. That was about league average. When Fred VanVleet was off the floor, that went from not 43, not 42, not 41, not 40. It went all the way down to 34.7%, which would have been dead last in the NBA.
Big change.
So without Fred VanVleet, like you said at the top, this is a much, much more desperate situation for Houston Rockets to find some three-point shooting. And if he can do that, it's just going to unlock a new level and make things easier for guys like Kevin Durant. And he kind of vanished in the second half, wasn't able to get the ball, didn't get the type of shots that you would expect from Kevin Durant, especially how good he looked in the first half. And I will say this, Dan, we've gotten overexcited before on opening night. I want to remind people, last year, I kind of forgot about this, but now in retrospect, how big it was that Jason Tatum hit 8 of 11 threes in opening night after the finals run, just how kind of a smoother delivery and all the work that he did in the offseason. After that night, he shot 33.8% for the rest of the regular season after that 8-for-11 night. Paolo Banchero went 4-for-8 on opening night and then shot 31% through the rest of the season. And of course, something that's near and dear to our hearts here at Big Number, we recorded a whole episode about how Russ is destroying the Nuggets offense and they're never going to have a good offense again. And they proceeded to had 87 points in opening night. Russ was a minus 24, and it looked like it was going to be an awful season in Denver. And they were pretty good last year. They finished with an offensive rating of, I've got it here, 118, which was good for top five in the NBA. So I was big wrong about that. Do you have any favorite, we were loud wrong on opening night, knee-jerk responses?
Yeah, two that came to mind for me. One I was in the building for and one I was not. I remember being at Barclays Center for Pelicans Nets a couple of years back. And it looked like the Pelicans were about to be a war machine. Like Zion and Brandon Ingram combined for like 53 points. Jonas Valanciunas was like dominating Nick Claxton. And it looked like, well, we expect the Nets are going to be good with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and that whole squad. And like, they're gonna figure it out. And the Pelicans are like, maybe if they can just push around Brooklyn like this, maybe the Pelicans have finally gotten like, how do we make the most out of Zion and Ingram together? And like, they figured it out. This is going to be like a 55 win war machine. And it was not. That didn't wind up happening, actually.
Yeah. But neither were the Nets. So,
in fairness, neither were the Nets. And then the other one was a couple of years before that. It was the 2020-21 season. So when after the start of the pandemic, and then the season shifted several months, and the start of the next season. So it started in December, and that was Warriors versus Nets. The start of that season, and that was the Warriors team where it was like Steph and Draymond and Wiggins, but like Klay was still hurt and it was all the young guys. I remember watching that game and I'm like, James Wiseman's got it. Like James Wiseman.
What was James Wiseman opening night that year?
He started at center in that game and he had like 19 points, 6 rebounds in 24 minutes. He made a three. He was like huge and he looked super fluid and screen and dive and lob finishes. And I'm like, if he's doing this early off of this kind of like without many reps, without many opportunities, he's going to be a monster for them. And that didn't work out so hot either. I think he was like, wound up getting hurt shortly thereafter that. And then like the Warriors figured out, oh no, we need to play small ball all the time. Draymond at the five. Like this is the way our team works. Yeah. And it wound up winning them another title. And then Wiseman, multiple injuries and never really got back to where he was, where it seemed like he would be. But yeah, I'm capable pretty quickly of going like, they figured it out. They got it. They absolutely nailed it. It's perfect. And then you are reminded that like one out of 82 might not have all the answers packed into it.
In pursuit of us being called wise men, Dan, I am going to continue my exuberance, my optimism around Alperen Şengün and say by season's end, he will be in the MVP conversation if he continues to shoot threes at a solid rate. That's a big if. Considering, this year in Eurobasket, he did shoot more, 4-7 against Jokic in that huge matchup. So maybe this sticks, maybe it doesn't. Lots to get into opening night. Dan, that was really fun to talk Şengün and getting ahead of ourselves, of course. But yeah, Nuggets almost beat Oklahoma City Thunder in the Western Conference semis. And so it turns out they were actually pretty good last year. So at the risk of sounding like a moron in a couple weeks when Şengün doesn't hit any more threes, let's get into some little numbers after the break. We will be right back. Before we go, a reminder to everyone watching, you can watch this show, The Big Number, on Yahoo Sports Network, which is available to stream on leading fast services. It's also streaming live 24/7 on yahoosports.com. It's .tv now, Dan. That's where you can catch all the shows on your phone or your browser. Go check us out on yahoosports.tv. All right, this week's big number, 5. That's how many three-pointers? Still kind of crazy to say out loud. Alperen Şengün had in the opening night game against the Oklahoma City Thunder. Career high for Alpi. Let's see what happens going forward. 4 little numbers. Opening night, optimism, craziness, newness. Dan, what do you got?
We're going to shift to the late game for our first little number. And it's still pretty new, but it's a continuation of something we saw last season. Our first little number is 0.778, said alternately, 77.8%. That is the Golden State Warriors winning percentage across regular season and playoff games when they've got Stephen Curry, Jimmy Butler, and Draymond Green all available. They are now 28-8 with all three of those guys in the lineup. After dispatching the Lakers on opening night, And I mean, we all sort of know the Lakers were coming in at less than full strength without having LeBron James as his ongoing recovery from sciatica. But still, 119-109 for the Warriors. Jimmy Butler, monster game, 31 points. 5 rebounds, 4 assists, 16 for 16 from the free throw line. His superpower, we've talked about that, his ability to generate possessions, to protect possessions, and to generate free throws. Draymond Green, you know, making a pretty miserable debut for DeAndre Ayton and the rest of the Lakers front court on the defensive end. The Lakers only have a 110 offensive rating in the game, even though Luka Doncic went nuts in a losing effort. You get huge contributions from our boy, Jonathan Kuminga, who we could talk about or not talk about, totally fine. And Buddy Hield, as you mentioned, 5 threes off the bench. We have on this show, the end of last season, we've done a deep dive on the impact that Jimmy Butler made, the transformational influence he was for the Warriors after that trade deadline acquisition. We talked about them in their playoff run. We talked about last week the kind of stealth MVP case for Stephen Curry if the Warriors wind up being really good. It's only one game against a shorthanded Lakers team, but how seriously do you think we should be taking the Warriors as a title contender, Tom?
I think they're in my top tier, and I have this written down at tomthefinder.com on my Substack, the weekly title tiers I do. My opening night title tiers, I had the Golden State Warriors in the top tier, 5-star tier, with Denver and with OKC. After one night, I feel pretty good about that. I don't feel, it wasn't like they blew out the Lakers. They kept them at arm's length the entire game. It felt like that every time the Lakers tried to make a run, the Warriors answered, and Jimmy Butler was awesome. I don't think he's going to score 30 points a night, but the kind of, we're going to leverage our high IQ players and just dismantle your defense, and you're just not going to be able to close that gap if you're shorthanded like the Lakers. I think with all of the histrionics of Marcus Smart and the flopping, and that was a very dangerous play that he had against Steph where he wrapped up his shoulder. And that stuff is really, I don't know how officials keep falling for the Marcus Smart thing, but that's not a credible defense. It's not against Steph. It's not. And the Lakers don't have a credible defense right now. DeAndre Ayton covered him the last 2 years with the Blazers. And I think what you saw in opening night is a lot of the same things that we saw in Portland, which is like, if he's locked in high motor, he's one of the better starting fives in the NBA. But if he's not, then you're going to have a tough time having a cohesive defense. The physicality needs to be there. Luka needs that guy behind him in the same way that they had, you know, two bigs, elite defensive bigs in Dallas. And it was like, okay, if you have a rim protector that can muscle up the back line and really make things easier for point of attack defenders and Luka, it's going to be great. It's going to be a good situation. But with the Golden State Warriors and the way they can pick you apart and the off-ball defense with Steph Curry and how much he can just create so much gravity, they're just going to pick you apart. And so that's what I like to see, is that the Warriors use that kind of intel and championship mentality and all of that stuff that they have at their disposal in droves. And they used it in pretty impressive fashion against the Los Angeles Lakers. And as good as Luka was, I think they have a lot of answers that they have to have on the defensive end. They got to search for that.
Well, picking up on that point, our second little number this week is 119.7. That was the Lakers' defensive rating last night with Luka Doncic and Austin Reeves together on the floor. If 119.7 sounds like a lot, it's because it is. That would have been down near the bottom of the league in defensive efficiency last season. It is also notably worse than what the Lakers had when those two guys were on the court during the back end of the regular season, when the Lakers were kind of a surprisingly really good defense after the Luka trade, and then when they struggled mightily against the Timberwolves in the first round, that sort of ignominious defeat where J.J. Redick basically by the end of the game, end of the series, didn't trust anybody and was playing five guys. In a related note, Luka Doncic played 41 minutes on opening night with like a 37% usage rate. So yeah, the obviously some of that is just LeBron not being there, but I think we're going to see it. Maybe the best argument for Luka's MVP case is that he's going to be out there all the time and he's going to have the ball constantly because that's what it looked like. But in terms of the defensive end, again, one night, one game, small sample size, and you're playing against the Warriors who they are different than everybody, right? Because of the Stephen Curry off-ball movement, because of the way that they can play with sort of 2 point forwards in having Jimmy and Draymond initiating and the structure just being so different. But one of the biggest questions we had heading into this season was how do the Lakers construct a championship caliber defense or even a average defense when your best offensive players, the guys that are you need to have on the court and that are going to be with the ball in their hands the most to create for you, are defensive negatives, which Luka Doncic has been throughout his career, which Austin Reeves has been throughout his career, and which LeBron James is at this point in his career because he's going to be 41 years old. And the glass half full optimistic case was Ayton he has shown at times the capacity to be a really active physical defender, was the backline anchor of a finals team. Marcus Smart has been, former defensive player of the year, hasn't really played on a good team consistently for a few years, but has been at that level. Jake LaRavia, really good gap defender, good hands, guys that can be good help defenders. One night, one game against the Warriors, but it does seem like those questions are going to be awfully loud until the Lakers show they can tamp down a pretty good offense.
Yeah. I've got big concerns about the Lakers right now. I mean, did the LeBron look like he was close or engaged or
didn't look happy when they went over to him that one shot where it looked like I'm not mad, I'm disappointed kind of the look from the bench. I think we've been on the receiving end of that. Maybe as dads, we've given that look, but did not seem thrilled.
I got to imagine there's going to be some changes in Lakerland this year because this defensive outfit is not going to work. And look, Steph wasn't even Steph in that game. So like he had a solid night, but 3-9 from downtown, it wasn't like he was, vintage Steph, which if that were to happen, this would have been over quickly. So I've got my concerns. I got them as a 2-star title contender. A lot of the concerns I have is what you saw in this opening night game where it's just like they need Marcus Smart to be all defense and lock down about 3 different players in order for them to have like tread water defensively. I don't see it. So Luka was great. I just think the supporting cast, there's 4 players on this roster that are above average according to EPM, and the Warriors have 8 players that are above average in EPM. And you saw it in this opening night loss for the Lakers. So got big concerns. What's next?
Well, if you're not handling things so well on the defensive end, maybe you got to try to junk things up. Brings us to our third little number, 28. That's how many possessions of zone defense the Houston Rockets played on Tuesday, according to Synergy Sports tracking. 28 possessions of zone defense, just slightly above what Houston averaged last season. 4.5 possessions of zone per game last season, 28 on opening night against Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City scored 23 points on those possessions, so that average 0.821 points per possession. Not really good. Really good.
And well, not good for OKC, yes. But really good for Houston.
Yes, very good for the defense. That would that kind of, among teams that actually play more than a couple of possessions a game, that 0.82 would be like at or near the top of the league every year. You go back in the Synergy database. Now, when I say 4.5 a game, and this is obviously like, quite a lot more than that, the Rockets really leaned heavier into their zone later last season. I think after specifically Ime Udoka found that double big lineup and settled on it and was like, well, if we are huge and we can sort of put on that pressure at the point of attack with big wing defenders, this really helps us out on the defensive end of the court. So they ran it a ton later in the season last year. They ran it a ton against Golden State in the first round. And Udoka seems ready to lean even harder into it with all the size that he's got now. If you've got like Amen Thompson and Jabari Smith Jr. at the top of your zone, like your arms are everywhere. And that's a really, really difficult thing for an offense to pass around and through or over the top of. This has been sort of like a change of pace for most teams, right? Like so it's been 20 odd years since the defensive rules change in zone came in. And you're starting to see, I think, year after year, more and more teams lean into it a little further. What did you make of just like how much Houston was going into it in game one, how effective it seemed for them? Do you think this is going to be like, we're just going to see the trend line continue to tick up as teams kind of go to this more often?
I think OKC is going to see this all the time this year. I think it's a copycat league. Houston was successful in doing it. We saw it in the postseason. And I don't know if it's going to be such a good thing for the opponent to use as much as Houston does with their length. They're like very, very well equipped to do a very effective zone. Also, they couldn't hit a shot, OKC. That's it was right. Awful. So many open threes that they could not hit. What was the final number? 13 of 52 or something like that, I think was the final count.
I think that's right. And, you know, 25%, not a particularly big number when we're talking about three-point accuracy.
No. So if they hit four of those, five of those, this is a totally different story. We're not going to go into double overtime. It's going to be over pretty quickly if they're hitting those shots. But that was such an epic game. And I couldn't believe as we're watching it, like in the first few minutes, I just thought that the Houston offense was so in the mud and just not getting good looks. And it was just, please, KD, bail us out, rescue us from this carnage of an offense. And I looked at the score bug, which is very interesting from NBC. They were winning the whole time.
Yep.
And it's because that zone and OKC not hitting their shots. OKC just couldn't get things going, and SGA was not in rhythm, was feeding teammates rather than looking for his own shot, and it threw him off their game. I think we're going to see a lot of teams try this. I don't think it'll be nearly as successful as we saw with Houston.
Yeah, and to your point, that was something that the Nuggets threw at them in the second round of the playoffs of last year. David Adelman dialed up the zone quite a bit against OKC. Rick Carlisle went to it some, not a ton, but some in the finals. So yeah, it's part of the blueprint. It's weird to say blueprint because it's not exactly like everyone's got a great script on how to beat the 68-win team that won the championship, but it's part of the book of like something that's worth giving a try to. Also, you sometimes will run zone if you're trying to protect a weaker defender. And that might bring us to our fourth and final little number this week, which is -8.9. That was Houston's net rating in the 28 minutes that Reed Shepherd played on opening night. You dig into the numbers, they don't actually look that bad defensively. He had a block, a steal, five deflections. The Thunder scored 10 points in 11 man-to-man possessions with him guarding, according to Synergy. So not awful. But it certainly felt like every time Reed Shepherd was on the floor, the Thunder said, bring him up. I want him. And that chicken didn't work out so hot. So I know, Tom, you have been a pretty big supporter of Reed Shepherd as a potential answer here for the Rockets. What was your takeaway from his performance on opening night?
My son, we had a family meeting last night. We had a family meeting after the game. Look, my father, just for some backstory here, my father-in-law went to University of Kentucky.
Okay.
My wife grew up in Louisville, raised Big Blue Nation. Okay. Watched a lot of Reed Shepherd. And so I was big on him at Kentucky, very excited to talk about him on draft night at the Yahoo Sports draft night. I was like, look, I think he's going to be the best player in this class, taken number three by Houston. I was excited that other people, very smart people around the league, viewed him as an elite talent at Kentucky one season with Rob Dillingham coming off the bench. And I just thought, you know, this guy is, in the same way that Şengün was baby Jokic, I thought he was baby Steph. Was the shooting numbers were insane. Second gen player. A guy who was grown up around the game and just had a basketball IQ that was off the charts. Loved watching him play. And last season was a big dud. Got to be honest, it was not a great rookie season for my son. And after the opening night loss to OKC, in which they went at him and targeted him, if this continues, I think the family, we would like to ask Reed Shepherd be put into the transfer portal and get out of Houston. Because, Dan, he looked scared out there. Like, he looked not an NBA player last night. He was tentative. Coming off of the pick and rolls, he almost felt like he was scared to be assertive, wasn't really getting into the paint. And then when he was, Ryan Russillo was like tweeting out, I would like to not see Reed Shepherd get stuck. As much as I am tonight. And I was like, yeah, every time he turned a corner, it was like he picked up his dribble and had to pass out of it. And there was a really bad clutch play where he threw it away after getting, you know, hitting a dead end, not keeping his dribble alive. And I was just like, oh no, my heart breaks watching every play down the floor, because I know he can, I know he's better than this. And part of me wonders, Dan, as the number three overall pick on a team that needs him to be a contributor right away to a championship. They got Kevin Durant on this team. They got Alperen Şengün, aspiring MVP candidate on the team. They can't have a project out there. And I'm wondering if Ime Udoka is not the right coach for him, only because I'm not totally parenting this and saying my son.
You're
is
a
not
little
at
bit parenting
this.
It. I respect that.
But it kind of feels like he needs a change of scenery. If we see this more, I'm gonna say we need to be put in the transfer portal for my son, Reed Shepherd. Because it just feels like this isn't the right situation for him. He looked scared out there, and I feel like they need to let him be Reed Shepherd, and it just seemed like he was tentative.
I hear what you're saying, Tom. And obviously, you have an emotional connection to this. I'm not gonna try to disparage that or you know, look askance at that. I would say that the premise of Reed Shepherd working as kind of like not the Fred VanVleet replacement, but as somebody who can help fill that void was A, he's going to be, you know, he's going to work his tail off defensively. He's got great hands. He's going to get steals and deflections. And we saw some of that. But he's going to have to be lights out on the offensive end to make it work. He's going to have to be a credible threat to get to the rim, to pull up from wherever, stretch the floor on the catch and shoot. And, you know, 3 for 11, 2 for 7 from three, as you mentioned, really tentative, looking to create is not going to get that done. It's not going to be the get back you need when you have like a smaller defensive player. Now, maybe he is just, it's just by virtue of him being the smallest defensive player on the floor at all times. So he's going to be the most glaring target. But
he's got to move his feet. He's got to move his feet better. And he's got great hands. So oftentimes he has gotten blocks and steals by poking the ball away out from someone who's gotten by him. But that can't be your first mode of attack, is to like, let my guy, Matador defense, let my guy get past me. And then maybe I can block him from behind. That can't be your first option.
Yeah. And there was Steph Noe at the Sporting News had a pretty good kind of like compilation of some of his closeouts and the way he was trying to address Oklahoma City drivers. And yeah, there was a lot of like jumping out on the high side and kind of giving the pathway towards the basket as opposed to closing out sort of square and staying in front. And so that's going to have to change. And obviously Ime Udoka is not the kind of coach who's going to allow that lack of attention to detail to stand on the defensive end, especially if you're not bringing what you need to bring on the other end of the court. So the glass half full, the more optimistic look is you are not going to have to deal with trying to create space against Cason Wallace every night. You are not going to have to guard Shai Gilgeous-Alexander on switches every night. But pretty much everybody in the league does have somebody who's going to try to put the microscope on you and say, we're going to draw you out. We're going to mismatch hunt and find you if you are a weak link. And that is going to be the challenge that he's going to have to deal with. So we'll move out on this. You obviously, again, you're coming at this from a very emotionally invested perspective.
Dan, I picked him sixth man of the year in the Yahoo Sports roundtable.
Well,
and along
listen.
With KOC, I guess we're not, I'm on an island here with KOC that I had big, big expectations for Reed. And maybe we're just making too much of one game against the defending champs.
And that's the question that's got to be rattling around in the brain of Raphael Stone, the Rockets sort of head personnel honcho, is this, we got a 21-year-old who barely ever got rotation minutes last year, and he's been dealing with Cason Wallace all night and getting hunted by SGA. So like, let's give him some time. Or is this, that's the bar we've got to clear to win this conference. Let's start drafting up what those trade proposals are going to look like as soon as December 15th hits. Which side of that spectrum, which end of it do you land on if you're in the Rockets front office right now?
I think, as a partial viewer of the situation, that it might be tough for him to reach his potential in Houston with everything that's going on. And maybe I'm wrong, but it felt like he was playing in a box and was afraid to do some things offensively, and it just, I think OKC could smell blood. So So we did a lot on Houston and OKC. Let's go to the media room. Let's talk about MJ and the sit down. I was locked in, and I want to hear your thoughts about Michael Jordan's sit down with Mike Tirico at halftime on NBA on NBC on Tuesday night. Let's talk about it right after the break. Back. So what would it be? Instead of a fax, is it just like on a Snapchat? Is it on like it's a TikTok that he would send out that he's back?
Yeah, I was gonna say notes app, but then that would read like an apology. And I don't think Michael Jordan should have to apologize for being back.
No, he's not. It's nice. No, he's not. Sitting down with Mike Tirico at halftime with his new segment as a special contributor to NBC's NBA coverage. It was the first episode, the debut of MJ, Insights to Excellence. Dan, did you notice that the logo has a little six in it, Roman numeral?
I did. You know, graphic design is my passion, and I did notice that. And I think it's a nice way to remind everybody that he has six championships, which is more than LeBron James. So that's good. That's a good way to start this process.
Was there end like 0-0 somewhere in there that we have to go back and watch and look at the logo and study it some more in a cryptic way? I found myself rooting for nostalgia on this Tuesday night. I felt like the whole entire NBA on NBC broadcast, it was a little rough in the beginning with some mic issues on the floor, but everything after that, the intro video, the music, the lasers, I was so excited. It felt like the first real spring day, you know, like you're coming out of winter and that first amazing spring day where it's like 70 degrees out and the birds are chirping and you just feel like, oh, I miss this so much. And I'm looking forward to how this is going to go for the next several months. That's how I felt watching this program. The production was really, really nice. And the picture quality was great. And then we got to the MJ interview and we got like a couple minutes of a sit down interview. The first time we've really heard from Michael since The Last Dance. So it's been like 4 or 5 years since we've heard him talk, you know, in a sit down forum like this. And I got to say, I thought that anecdote about the free throws and going to Ryder Cup and staying at someone's house and them asking him to take a shot. And he admits, I haven't picked up a basketball in years. I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
I was a little sad. I was like, oh man, like Michael, he's big into NASCAR now. Like he's changed, you know, sports in terms of his day to day, no longer with the Charlotte Hornets in a full-time capacity. But to hear that MJ hadn't picked up a basketball in like a real serious, like shooting hoops for like four or five years, he said, I was like taken aback by that. So Dan, what were your thoughts? You know, as a consumer, as a fan, as a children of, you know, the 90s, a child of the 90s, and just like watching the Bulls in like the formative years as a basketball fan, this was I thought this was a first episode success debut for Michael Jordan.
Yeah, so there's a few layers to this. One of them is just I thought it was very smart of NBC to sort of begin its coverage by linking. By showing the players that would show up on the NBA on NBC so often in those years, like you are seeing Michael Jordan, you're seeing Reggie Miller, you're seeing Patrick Ewing, you're seeing some of these guys that were like the superstars of those, you know, weekend doubleheaders that you saw so often on NBA and NBC, and like tethering them. Like, seeing Michael Jordan made it feel like the NBA on NBC. So on a very basic level, I thought that was a smart kind of bridge from then to now. And that, as you mentioned, yeah, they understand that the itch that is being scratched here for people of our generation, a little bit older, is a nostalgia play. And so you're going with that. You're going with the peacock colors and the lasers, and you're going into Round Ball Rock. You're going into those people. Like, that is what that is for. And so I thought that was super smart. And then there was also a point where, as I was a young person watching those games in the early 90s and the mid 90s, I was a Knicks fan who hated Michael Jordan. So at a certain point, I was like, oh, I don't want to see this dude anymore. I was like, no, no more Michael Jordan. So the fact that it was only a couple
Pat,
of minutes.
You're like looking at Patrick Ewing. Like, oh, yes. My my sweet Patrick Ewing.
Yes. Yes. I was very happy to see Patrick Ewing, and I was not very happy to see Michael Jordan. Brought back some very bad memories. But there's also the story that you're mentioning where he had the anecdote of I hadn't picked up a basketball in so many years. And then all of a sudden I had like a kid wanted me to take a shot. And I was thinking like this kid knows the legend of who I was. That was, I don't know how many times in my life I've thought of Michael Jordan as like human and relatable. That was an extraordinarily like vulnerable thing. The idea of, yeah, no, you can't just pick up a basketball because you used to be Michael Jordan. Like, so what happens if you miss the shot in front of everybody? Like, oh, you know, the idea that there's no place that you can go except perfect. That's got to be a really hard place to be. So it made me think of Michael Jordan as a character in a very different light than what my nostalgia did. So I thought that was interesting. I thought that was compelling. I thought hearing
Did you believe him?
No, I think he was lying. I think that either he was lying about the story on the whole or about making the shot.
Do you think he would? I don't think he would have. Like, are we going to get Pablo Torre, like a report? The kid is on the program. Like, I took video of it. He didn't actually make the free throw.
Yeah, he airballed it and then he fell down and he slipped in a puddle. Yeah, I think like I can't imagine Michael Jordan being able to accept a defeat in that way without lying about it.
But so, he's not going to tell the story if he missed it. Now that I'm thinking about it, he had to have made it because otherwise he would have just like memory holed it. It didn't happen.
Or he's success, you know, it's the Jordan Crawford dunk on LeBron or whatever, right? It's he's successfully gotten all the footage and there's no, you know, there's no way you can, there's NDAs out the wazoo and nobody could possibly confirm or deny. So I think that's part of it. Then when we get sort of outside of that, it got to the end and I was kind of like, oh, that was it? Like, that's what the Michael Jordan contributions to this programming is going to be? Like 2 minutes of him talking to Mike Tirico in a room and just kind of saying stuff? If that is all it is, that's fine. Like, I didn't find it like a negative or detracting experience, but I was kind of like, oh, I think maybe I thought Michael Jordan was going to engage with what's happening now a little bit more than this. And maybe that's not what he wanted. I don't know. But I mean, to talk about, I'm appearing here because it's important for me to give back to the game. I think that's a wonderful sentiment. And then I'm wondering, well, how does that work out in practice if what this is sort of like a hermetically sealed, we're slicing off 90 seconds at a time stories, that doesn't seem to engage quite as much. But maybe I'm open to the possibility of being wrong about that for sure.
I had high hopes. And then I saw the little blurb on the side, the little ad, the tease for next week. Did you see that?
Run it back for me. Tell me what we saw there.
Next week, MJ on load management.
Well, I'm gonna make a prediction here, Tom. I think he's probably gonna be against it. I think he's probably not gonna be particularly
it's gonna open pay it forward, you know? It's gonna pay forward. You know, he has a duty to the game, to respect the game. You don't take any days off. You don't go to Atlantic City during the playoffs and play cards all night before a playoff game. You know, you don't do that. You respect the game. But he always delivered. So it was, you know, he could say like, I wouldn't have taken days off because I, you know, respect the game too much and I love the game too much. And there's a duty to play, even if you're banged up. Like, I know that's what he's going to say.
Sure.
But I really don't want cranky old Michael Jordan, Abe Simpson yelling at the clouds too much. I want a little bit of it because I want the humility and just like to see him in his element of just like he's got a lot of bones that he wants to pick. He's got a lot of scores that he wants to settle and some chips on his shoulder that he wants to, you know, rub off. Like we saw the Hall of Fame speech and what that was all about. I really liked this episode and the idea of Michael Jordan paying it forward. But it feels like it's just going to be, and I hope I'm wrong, that it's just going to be old head, basketball head, who's kind of dumping on current players. I'm worried that that's where it's going to veer into, is I'm going to pay it forward and it's going to be all about the respect for the game. But there's going to be a little bit of venom behind what I'm saying towards today's basketball, today's era. And I don't think that's what we want, or at least Adam Silver of the NBA. I mean, maybe they want NBA players to play more and respect the integrity of the game, to like play through, you know, if you're not injured, try to play through more of those things and make our TV partners happy and our fans happy. But I don't know if this is necessarily what we want to hear, is Michael Jordan dumping on current players.
I completely understand the fear that that's what it's going to turn into. I think because we've been largely conditioned to expect that by our legendary players over the last couple of decades, right? Like, the undercurrent of much of what the coverage, the color commentary, the analyst commentary on ESPN and on Turner was a lot of like guys being like, this guy wouldn't have been able to do that in my day. And, you know, this guy couldn't hold, you know, couldn't lace up my shoes. And not everybody, and not exclusively. And there are times where it was a lot, where it was laudatory, but it definitely feels like this new iteration of the media deal, and NBC as a partner coming in, and Amazon as a partner coming in, and restructuring what this looks like a little bit, is geared towards celebration and geared toward bringing in a generation of players who are a little bit more recently removed from the game, who might be a little bit more willing to compliment and promote and publicly praise what is they're seeing in front of them, as opposed to saying like, here's why it's not as good as Michael Jordan. I will be interested to see if Michael Jordan is open to that as well.
Is he going to look back at his executive performance with the Wizards and Kwame Brown and the Hornets? Is he going to look back at that and say, maybe I don't have all the answers on how to best construct teams and winning and success in today's era? Do you think he will have a moment of humility and self-awareness that maybe he doesn't have all the answers on this front? But then again, I don't know if we want like hedging Michael Jordan.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I will say I'm maybe more willing to believe that's possible after he led with the story about being like, oh man, I got to make this shot because this kid, like, there's
having
there was a
anxiety
level of,
about playing basketball is like a very surprising anecdote from
it was
Michael
it was
Jordan.
Shocking and yeah, shocking in that regard, and vulnerable in a way that I don't know that we've seen him all that often publicly over the course of his career. With the, I mean, the example of that, like the gigantic Wright Thompson story when he turned 50, right? Like, there was some of that years ago, but like hasn't been a ton of it. And so I think I would be very surprised if there was that level of sort of, you know, retrospective humility or introspection that comes out of it. It just doesn't match with the mythos. But I also think it does feel like if the overarching thrust of what you're looking to get from this coverage is a little bit more, you know, up with people, boosterism and positivity, then like that would be discordant. But also maybe it's everything else is going to do that, which leaves the lane for Michael to sometimes deliver some harsh truths. I don't know. But I think I'm interested in seeing how those two things either coalesce or run on parallel tracks over the course of this partnership. But yeah, I think I came away from the overall presentation initially being like, this is like, oh, what if we just talked about this like we liked it? And that felt like a pretty cool zag to me.
Yeah. I wonder how Mike Tirico is going to, like, what, as I think Mike Tirico would be on that side of, let's celebrate the game. Let's celebrate. Sure. I thought he did an excellent job in play by play. And I'm biased because we went during our spring break last year. We went to New York City and we ran into Mike Tirico outside of FAO Schwartz. We're waiting in line and Tirico's is walking across the street and he sees me and he sees my daughters. He's like, "Hey, Tom," like, "Hey." And he's like, "Hey, what are you guys doing?" And he talked to my daughters for like 20 minutes in his suit.
Wow,
he was just on air on the Today Show. And he couldn't have been nicer. It was great. And my daughter watching the game last night, because Mike Tirico was on the pregame shows and stuff, she's like, "I know that guy. Hey, wasn't he the one that we saw in the streets of New York City in Manhattan?" I was like, "Yeah, right at Rockefeller Center. There he was." And watching him sit down with Michael, and clearly Michael's comfortable talking to Mike Tirico. And I'm curious to see how this plays out, where Mike is going to, you know, as the representative of the brand, steer the conversation in a more like, we want the best Michael Jordan, but how is that going to have friction with also representing the game in a positive light and celebrating the today's NBA? It's going to be interesting. I'm going to watch, obviously, next week's load management thing, because I've been covering that side of the game for quite a while. Sure. I already know what I'm kind of already like preemptively have my wits about me on that. But I think after what I saw in this episode and that vulnerability that you talked about, I think I kind of have a little bit more optimism that it might be a more nuanced conversation. But maybe we'll have to see.
I would agree with that. And also, next time your kids do that, just remind them, like, hey, I'm on TV too. No, it's not just Mike Tirico.
Dad,
it's me.
Loser. Dad, like, nope. She doesn't.
Hey, I'm on yahoosports.tv 24/7. You log into your browser, daughters. Watch.
Throw on the Samsung and let's turn on the Yahoo Sports channel. And then she's like, oh, you're not. Oh, no.
Fine.
Were you on the Today Show? I don't think so. You know?
Today's big number is zero. Snob, zero respect from our children. It's incredible.
Yeah. All right, Dan. Let's give some respect out to our audience that have been watching this show. Thank you so much. Numbers have been great. And thank you if you can 5-star review wherever you listen on podcasts, and go check us out on YouTube. Check us out on yahoosports.tv, like Dan mentioned. Watch us on TV. That's right. Mike Tirico, take that. Yeah. You think Mike's watching this? I'm not sure.
He better be.
Which Mike are we talking about? You know, maybe MJ is watching this show.
That'd be amazing. That'd be really amazing.
I'm locked in for next week. I can't wait to see how it goes. Alpi Şengün, Reed Shepard, the big three in Golden State, and the zone defense making a call. Dan, that was a great episode. Thanks so much. Really appreciate you doing this. And yeah, I'm sure we're going to have a lot of knee-jerk responses to this episode, and we'll see what happens next week.
Yeah, I can't wait to see how wrong we are about the things we talked about today and what we can be wrong about next week, Tom. That's the promise, is that we're going to keep giving it an effort here on The Big Number.
All right. I want to thank TJ behind the scenes. Thanks so much for subbing in today and producing the show. TJ, Emmy, and the entire squad, we'll be back next week with another episode of The Big Number. Until then.